You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and what you just heard is a recording from an action that opened Operation First Casualty at Union Square in San Francisco last Friday. Black Friday, as it is known, is the day after Thanksgiving, one of the busiest shopping days in America, and the streets around Union Square were crowded. A small contingent of uniformed combat troops, members of Iraq Veterans Against War, burst into a cafe on the square and arrested a number of patrons. Those arrested were actually participants, but the majority of cafe patrons didn't know that. And the arrestees were forced to kneel on a small patch of grass nearby where bags were pulled over their heads. These soldiers were simulating the sort of aggression that is demanded of them in Iraq. The arrestees' confusion and screaming alerted shoppers to what was going on, and I noticed a variety of reactions. Some shoppers stopped and stared, their faces shocked, others fled the scene, and still others pretended they hadn't seen a thing and simply kept on walking. First performed on March 19th last year in downtown Washington, D.C., Operation First Casualty aims to show the American public the truth of the U.S. occupation in Iraq. Garrett Rappenhagen, IVAW board chair and one of the organizers of the D.C. event, said, "We call the action Operation First Casualty because we believe that truth was the first casualty of this war. It is time for the American people to know the truth so they will act to bring the troops home." IVAW has performed this event in other U.S. cities, and the one in San Francisco was ambitious. After making these arrests, troops hustled the arrestees down to nearby Yerba Buena Center, where they simulated waterboarding. They also stormed into Bloomingdale's. Then, near busy Market Street, they simulated the activity that occurs at military checkpoints in Baghdad. The event had just begun, arrestees were being handled aggressively by uniformed but unarmed troops, and shoppers were beginning to gather. Let's start off hearing from Michael, who was standing near me.
Is this for fake? Is this real?
This is a Baghdad square.
Yeah, okay. So it's not real.
Yeah.
The guys that, with the... This is a bit. This isn't something, they're not arresting them. Until I talked to you, I didn't know. I thought this is a real thing.
So. And so when you walked along, you felt immediately that you were in danger.
Yes, yes.
So I think what they're trying to do here is simulate a scene in Baghdad.
Yes.
To bring it home to people that really are not paying that much attention.
Right. This is very, 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 it wakes you up.
Effective, you think?
Yeah.
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 So, does it bring to mind the events going on in India at all?
Yes. Yes. That's automatically. That's what I thought about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, have you followed the war very much?
Yes.
The war. So, this is something that you obviously know about.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well,
what do you think's happening here?
Well,
what's your name?
My name is Gerard.
Uh-huh.
And well, it seems very clear to me that war is not something that feels good for anybody. It seems unfair. And it seems really nice that the soldiers are giving a really clear message of they're not even want to be there, no? Nobody wants the war. So I think it's pretty nice what they're doing. It's a very clear message to us.
It was a surprise to you?
Yeah, I was. I even got into tears because, you know, it's my baby that I have here. He's 4 months old, and we don't believe in violence and war anyway, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you here, you live here, or you're here?
No,
on
we
holiday?
Come. No, we're here on a holiday. We come here just to spend some days with the family.
From where?
From Oregon. We come from Oregon. From Saturn. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to have you. Thanks for being here and sharing this.
It's really, and then see the people like paralyzed. You know, that was very interesting to see. Also, like the world, you know, it's like keep going, and so many things are happening right now.
Yeah. So you didn't get, you got scared for a moment
at
there?
The moment was like, yeah, we thought it was the real thing, and then we realized, oh yeah.
Thanks a lot. Have a good Christmas.
You. Okay,
yeah.
You
take care. What's your name?
Gregory Sautier.
Gregory, this was a surprise?
Yes, yes.
Tell me about how it affected you. What?
Well, I was looking up there towards a Princess Tree, and all of a sudden, soldiers stormed onto the ground, grabbed people and threw them to the ground. And as I was watching it develop, I realized that this is the type of thing that's happening across the world in America's name. And it's very, very traumatizing for people to view it. It's, in my opinion, it seemed very, very unjust as well, because they were just grabbing everybody. And I don't know if this kind of stuff is happening, you know, in a lot of places, but seeing American soldiers being part of this is troubling to me.
Say more about that.
Well, seeing American soldiers being a part of this is troubling to me because I know that our youth in America really want to help make things safe and peaceful, and sometimes they're thrown into situations where they cannot understand what the effects of their actions are doing, especially in terms of U.S. military operations in foreign countries. And it's a real tragedy that our youth are being pushed into this position, and then unfortunately they'll probably have to deal with it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. And do you know this because you read a lot, or you were in the military, or?
Well, I do active counter-recruitment work in public schools. I'm a school teacher from Los Angeles. And I work with the Coalition Against Militarism in our schools, and we're working to demilitarize public high schools in America.
Thank you. What's your name?
Leslie Mullen.
Leslie, what do you think about what's going on in front of you?
Well, I came down to support this, the Iraqi Veterans Against the War. I think their voice is so important, and I don't think that they actually get as much media as they deserve. And they know the reality of the war. And I think this is a really excellent demonstration, and you see that a lot of people stop, a lot of the public watches this, and I think especially because they've been there, to see what it is like for people to live in an occupied country as civilians and be subject to this war.
Yeah, and actually a couple of people that I have interviewed here have been very touched to the point of tears, these a couple of men that I've talked to, and you can really see the impact of this.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've participated in actions like this at this time of year before, and I'm always struck about how much of the American public is moved to see this,
yeah,
because we don't really see this, we don't really understand.
And there's a reason for that.
Exactly, exactly.
Because it's very scary when you see it.
It is.
It's very
much is.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I followed the event down to Yerba Buena Center, where, as I mentioned, simulated waterboarding was enacted. While there, I noticed a young woman who apparently worked at the center take one look and become so frightened she began crying. I tried to comfort her and realized that she didn't speak English, and she just kept walking away and carrying her broom and her dustpan. The event organizers had engaged two psychologists, but I couldn't find them, and we'll hear more about that later. Meanwhile, I talked to Jane.
My name is Jane Song.
Okay, Jane, and you're part of the action today.
Yes, I am. I'm also a veteran, and I'm part of an organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War. And today, basically, what we're doing is called Operation First Casualty, which is a guerrilla theater, and we're all veterans of this war. And basically, what we're saying is that the troops don't want to be there, you know? And we're not showing that the troops are brutal, which they are, you know? But unfortunately, it's the situation that they're in. We're not blaming the troops. We're blaming the policies that put them in this position. Because at that point, you don't have a choice. It's either your buddies or them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you're going to stick with your buddies.
So read to us what you are reading out to the public at large today.
All right, these are not actors. These are veterans of the Iraq War. We're performing guerrilla theater called Operation First Casualty because the first casualty of war is the truth. And we're bringing the truth of the occupation to you, the truth you don't see on the news. As you're shopping and enjoying your holidays, remember there are still troops in Iraq who have lived these scenes every day. And it does not end when they come back. This is a war they fight for the rest of their lives. There are 18 suicides a day among vets. That amounts to 6,570 suicides a year. The collateral damage is on both sides. This is not a war we had to go into. It is a war based on lies, and the troops want this occupation to end. And we, as Iraq Veterans Against the War, call for the immediate withdrawal of all troops in Iraq, reparations to the Iraqi people, and taking care of the vets when they come back. We are not blaming the troops. We are the troops. We are blaming the policies that put soldiers, Marines, airmen, and seamen in an impossible situation where no one wins. Support us. Put pressure on Obama, on the new administration. Resist. Protest. Do what you got to do. Educate yourself. IVAW.org.
And you were over in Iraq or Afghanistan?
I was never deployed because of medical reasons, but my whole unit, they got deployed, and I saw the effects of that and them having to come back. And, like, as a soldier myself and not being deployed, you live with extreme guilt. And this is one way that I feel like I can help prevent more soldiers from coming back like this, because it is true, they live with it for the rest of their lives.
And you've been discharged now?
Yeah. I've been out for about 3 years now.
And how's it going for you?
Pretty good. You know, I'm a student at Cal, work my ass off. That's one thing the military taught me, to work hard.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this.
Thanks.
We're at the United Nations Plaza in San Francisco, and with me is Gillian Finn. Mm-hmm. Gillian, you are?
Member of Therapists for Peace and Justice.
And you're here today as a counselor.
Yeah, that's right.
And?
And the idea was, we know that in an activity like this, first of all, there are veterans taking part. There might well be veterans who have PTSD and who might have flashbacks, be triggered. Also, the possibility some of the victims might find the experience completely overwhelming and more than they anticipated as volunteers. And also to keep an eye open for people in the crowd in case you never know who's watching and what their life story is, and they might have been through an experience and be triggered as well.
Well, it's interesting. I was at the waterboarding at the Yerba Buena Center at the waterfall, and I was standing a little bit back from the crowd, mm-hmm. and a young woman who clearly worked at the Yerba Buena Center, she had a little the broom and the dustpan, mm-hmm. Walked past, and I actually walked up to her to see if she'd be willing to talk about her reaction to mm-hmm. it, and she was crying, mm-hmm. and I comforted her, but I don't think she spoke English very much.
Yes, I heard about that incident and felt really sad that we hadn't been right there in the spot. And I would say that was an issue of logistics. You know, we were asked to stay at a certain place, almost like your medvacs might, you know, and they bring people off the field to you if they get injured in war. I think that was the idea. But once we heard that, frankly, we sort of said to the organizers, we're going where the action is, we're going to follow in case something like that happens again. One of the other photographers told us. I heard that she was Spanish speaking too, which I felt really bad about because I speak Spanish. I could have talked to her. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but this is also the way it is in a regular combat zone.
Totally. Right? I'm quite sure. I mean, two counselors, you're never going to get be everywhere that people might need you. It sort of right. just brings it to life.
And you never know where people are from. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. know where she was from.
Yeah.
Central American country, you know, would understand what had been evoked there.
Absolutely could. And I actually lived a while in Nicaragua and was there during war times with Somoza. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I wish I had been there, but I wasn't. Well, I mean, and I hope she's okay.
I do too.
I'm glad to hear that you spoke to her, though. That's great. Because sometimes just one other human being, you know, being there and saying, are you okay?
Yeah, but I mean, the thing that I felt bad about was she has no context to place this. She's
yeah,
just
like, what
passing
is this
along,
about?
Yeah, exactly. passing around, you know, doing her job, and the next
That's
thing
right.
just sort of jumps out at her.
Yeah.
But were there any other incidents that you were involved in today?
Not incidents. Once we joined the combatants, we were scanning as we went through. You know, they went through Macy's and places. Do I mean Macy's? I can't
Bloomingdale's.
Remember. Bloomingdale's. That's right. So really, I just kept an eye. When I noticed people looking like horrified or sad, I just went up and said, are you okay? This is street theater.
Yeah.
And that seemed to help.
Yeah.
And I heard a child scream, and I kind of went over to see, but it was just a perfectly normal, sort of, was nothing to do with, and the parents were handling the child perfectly well, so left that alone and went back to the soldiers. So far, no. Talked to one of the victim participants, and she, I wouldn't, I'm not sure that she needs counseling, but it was good to talk with her because she had a really hard experience. I mean, it was very realistic for her, and she was describing having a hood over her head and being kicked and dragged, you know.
Yeah.
Hard.
Well, thank you for doing
You're
this.
You're so welcome, yeah. Susan.
That was Gillian Finn, a therapist for peace and justice, one of the psychologists working with Operation First Casualty in this event in San Francisco streets. Finally, a short clip from the IVAW presentation at the United Nations Plaza, followed by Matt Edwards, a former Marine. In the background, you can hear the waterfall at the UN Plaza.
Well, Operation First Casualty is a guerrilla theater where there are no actors. We are veterans of the Iraq war, and these are scenarios that we had done today that happen every single day in Iraq, where we have to go on patrol and gather up people from the community in places like Baghdad or wherever, and they get rounded up, and then they get hauled off to prisons and places where they're tortured, like the torture scenario that we did, or where they're interrogated, and it's very, very dehumanizing process that happens every day. And soldiers have to go through this every day and take fire, like the scenario that we did where I got hit with the fake blood. So we're bringing the truth of the occupation here to everybody in America. This has happened at many other cities all around the nation. And also, what we're doing here at UN Plaza is we're bringing food through Food Not Bombs, because we want to highlight the fact that there are a lot of homeless in this country, and a lot of them are veterans. And a lot of homeless right now that are returning, a lot of returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan are becoming homeless and also committing suicides. There's about 18 suicides a day amongst the veteran population in like 2007. And they're probably more, even higher today. So the people are down and out, and they just need support from the community, and that's why we're here as veterans, to let other homeless vets or whatever know that they got support, and that's why we're serving food to them to highlight that issue. So there'll be food here after this for everybody to take part of.
Hi, I'm Matthew Edwards. I'm with IVAW, Iraq Vets Against the War.
One of the organizers for today's event.
We are a non-hierarchical group, so we're sort of all the organizers. I took the point on coordinating today, yeah.
So Matt, you just mentioned that you were a CO and that you had your hip broken.
Yes, I enlisted right out of high school. This was during the Afghanistan war, before Iraq, when I was returning to train in mid-November of 2002. I informed my command that I was a conscientious objector and I couldn't participate in the upcoming war in Iraq, or the war that was happening in Afghanistan. Treatment began immediately. I was sleep deprived, not allowed access to food. I was given extra duties and I was punished more harshly than the others. When that failed to influence me to go back to train, I was beaten by my fellow Marines. When that failed to send me back to train, my hip was broken.
In one of those beatings?
It was actually a combination of the sleep deprivation, the stress positions they would put me in, as well as malnutrition, which weakened the bone in my hip. It was broken on a run. When it broke, I was told to continue to run. I was eventually sent to the corpsman, where when they found out that I was applying for CO status, refused to provide me any medical attention. That happened for a month. So that brings us to January. In January, continued to no medical attention. I was finally discharged in March, the day the war started.
And did you get CO status?
I was never given CO status. In fact, I was never allowed to speak with a lawyer. During the first month of the beatings, I was denied access to internet, telephone, or any contact with the outside world. I wasn't allowed to leave base, and they didn't let me speak to a lawyer.
And so you went in because...
I enlisted when I was 16 years old. I was a military cadet for 5 years prior to that.
Okay.
I believed in the lies that the recruiters sell. I believed that what we were doing around the world was positive and making the world a better place. The power games I saw in recruit training and the way that we were being trained to kill indiscriminately opened my eyes. And people who join the military rarely join the military to kill civilians. They join to help. And our foreign policy does not make that possible. So there was no way I could participate in those wars.
There's a sense that we're helping, and the actual truth when you get into the military, you realize it's not about helping at all. But talk about that marketing piece, about, you know, feeling like you're going to help.
The it's the images on TV. It depends how the media, the corporate media, really shows the military. When I was growing up, we had the police actions in Somalia where the Marines were going in to feed civilians. And that is sort of what was in my mind when I joined. I come from the inner city in Los Angeles, the Crenshaw District, when the riots happened in the early 1990s, I was seven. The military...
The Rodney King riots,
yes. Uh-huh. The military was sent in to restore order. So from a very early age, I associated the military with protection and helping. And I understood the history and sort of the job the military does. The military does kill. But you hope that the leaders are going to have you kill for a good cause, not corporate interests or oil.
And so at this point, you've learned a lot about how foreign policy works.
Yes, ma'am.
And?
I went to UC Santa Cruz after my discharge from the military. I have a degree in politics and Middle Eastern history. I lived in Syria for over a year, sort of seeing the effects of the refugee crisis in the Middle East and understanding that the people of the world are rightly justified in their anger towards American foreign policy.
And yet today, when these different events were going on in different places, a couple of people were extremely touched, brought to tears, in fact, and then other people were just like looking at it going, oh, it's just another one of those war, anti-war things.
I think that people's desensitization to violence is really interesting. There was nothing funny about what happened today, and while we are all volunteers in terms of the civilians or we are Iraq vets, this is reality for some people, and the government has put a freeze on these sort of actual pictures coming out of Iraq. We don't get these pictures. We're not allowed to see these pictures. So we have to bring it to the people in the form of street theater. And for those who were touched, rightly so, they should get out in the streets and demand an end to this war and all future wars like it. And for those who weren't touched, I would say look into your heart and realize that when people die, it has a dangerous effect on the rest of the world.
And it's kind of like the journey you've taken now. You went in thinking one thing, and you've come out really believing and seeing a different way of being. But that education piece doesn't often happen in the United States, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I was lucky. I look at being beaten and tortured as almost a price to pay to see the truth. I wish things could have been different. I wish that... the people I've met in my travels didn't have to be affected by war so much. And I'm glad that there's a group like IVAW out here really trying to show what's happening.
And you've really found a group now that you feel has your heart.
They're a bunch of good folks, absolutely.
Yeah, they are. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Matt Edwards, a member of Iraq Veterans Against War, acting as coordinator for Operation First Casualty Street Theater, with the aim of alerting the American public to the reality of war, with truth being the first casualty. Learn more about Iraq Veterans Against War and Operation First Casualty events at www.ivaw.org. You can also go to our website at www.raisingsandradio.org to listen to any of our archive shows with a variety of perspectives from active duty troops, resistors, military moms and families, Iraqis, Afghans, war resistors, psychologists, activists, policy and history experts, and veterans from other wars too. It's a reminder that this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford, FM 90.1, and I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. Regular listeners to Raising Sand Radio have followed with us the case of Troy Davis, who has had three stays of execution in the last 6 months. We're gratified to have seen and been part of the worldwide protest about this case, and today it is my great pleasure to introduce Martina Correa, Troy's sister and staunch supporter. Welcome, Martina Correa.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and as I say, we've been following this case and feel... really gratified to see the kind of outpouring about what's been going on here. So I'm going to ask you first to talk about Troy's state of mind and then learn about also where the case is at this point.
Well, yes. Well, first of all, I mean, Troy's state of mind is very good. Troy is such a prayerful person that, you know, of course, facing execution three times, it does stress you. I mean, it weighs on you, and it's more than any one person probably can bear. But, you know, Troy has such a strong family. He has a strong faith in God, And, you know, we just keep him close to us, and we keep visiting him. So he is in a good place. He's not falling apart. And it's amazing because even the other guys on the row are more upset than Troy, because they said if Troy can't get justice and we know he's innocent, then who can? Mm-hmm. So, you know, but he's in a good place.
And what does he think about this worldwide outpouring of outrage?
Well, you know, it's been amazing. I have been traveling. I mean, I've been to Canada. I've been to Switzerland. I've been to France. I've been to England. I've been all over in the last several years, and talking to people outside of Savannah, outside of Georgia, trying to make sure to let people know what's happening in Troy's case. And I think last year when the report Where's the Justice for Me came out on Amnesty International's website, you know, it's an independent study, but someone sat and read all of Troy's transcripts and put together, you know, a synopsis of his case. And I think that's what really outraged people, because they can see it wasn't a legal document. It wasn't a document that was anti-death penalty. It was a document full of the truth and facts about the case. And when people saw that, that's when all the conversations, all the discussions, all the things that I've been saying for years came to fruition. Because what happened was, before, people was treating me like, well, she's his sister, and of course his sister is going to say that he's innocent. Of course the sister is, you know, might be biased, or, you know, might be a personal thing. But then when they start reading the information for themselves, that's when all the international outpour just really, really just exploded.
And what has it been like for you? I mean, given that the state of Georgia has been so intransigent about this.
I have been, you know, I've been fighting this battle for a long time, and it's not something that I take lightly. It's been a battle for me. But it's not where, you know, when I walk around, I don't walk around and say, oh, hi, Troy is my sister. I don't whisper. Say, you know, my name is Martina Correa. And if people say, is Troy Davis your sister? I said, yes, he is. I mean, you know, my brother, I said, yes, he is. He's my younger brother. And I'm fighting, you know, to prove his innocence. So I was never ashamed of that. Georgia is a state that is entrenched in racism. It has been. I'm 41 years old. And I've gone places in the military and traveled around the world and almost just be ashamed to say that I'm from Georgia. And I see people come here from all over, and they're visiting and they're tourists. And I used to tell people, you know, we have all these majestic oak trees with the moss hanging, and people talk about how beautiful Savannah is. And I said, yeah, it's beautiful for some. But I said, Savannah has an underlying veil over itself. And I always used to say, if these trees could talk, they could tell a story of Savannah that nobody really wants to hear. And the thing about it is, people say, well, you know, you live in harmony, everybody gets along, you have a black mayor. And I said, no, the people of color are not in any charge. They're not on an equal playing field. The problem with our city is, as long as you don't cross certain lines, you're fine. As long as you know your place, you're fine. I'm an educated black woman, and I've been told by African-American people in certain settings that, Martina, you just need to smile, just look pretty, go along. And so it's not like, you know, I'm being told that by people that are non-black. I'm being told that by black people, because it's like, if you stand up against the system, it's political suicide. So my thing is, if you don't stand up, what are we doing for the younger people that's coming behind us? So
that's right.
You know, I don't mind challenging the system. I don't mind, you know, making people ask the question.
And at this point, as I understand it, there is an appeal that's going to be heard on December 9th?
Yes, there's an oral argument before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals on December 9th in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's open to the public.
What exactly is this going to be about, this hearing? I mean, there's been so many twists and turns in this case, haven't there?
Well, actually, what it will be is, it'll just be the lawyers in there, and they'll be arguing that actual innocence should take precedence over procedural bars and the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that's been hindering this case. That law was put into place in 1996, and the problem was it was made retroactive 10 years, and it only gives you 1 year to prove innocence. Well, if your witnesses don't come forward until 4 or 5 years later because you don't have a lawyer, then how do you expect to have a fair day in court. So they're going to be arguing the Eighth Amendment. They're going to be arguing, you know, Herrera, where, you know, U.S. Supreme Court did say that actual innocence should take precedence, but they didn't make it a federal mandate. They just, you know, made it where in that case, okay, yeah, we're giving relief, but the state of Georgia, you know, you don't have to go by federal laws. Each state has their own laws that they can govern the state, which means they can ignore federal laws. And, you know, in the United States, it's not unconstitutional to execute someone if you feel that they got a fair trial at the beginning. So, you know, what we're doing is we're denying people access to the courts based on political wrangling and technicalities, and then you have people who are factually guilty who get out on technicalities.
And what if the court decides in Troy's favor, what's the outcome for him at that point?
Well, first of all, they only get 20 minutes to argue. I mean, you get 20 minutes to argue.
For someone's life.
For somebody's life. Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really ridiculous. And during that 20 minutes, the justice is going to stop and ask you any questions. So you really don't get 20 minutes. And then there's a clock and a timer and a buzzer, and, you know, that's it. So
yikes.
Everything has to be in your brief. But what would happen is if he was to get relief, they could tell the lower courts that, yes, he is justified in being able to have his appeals open and go through the federal courts. And then they would tell the lower courts either you need to give him a new trial or at least a hearing. Now, a hearing, which means that you would just be able to sit before one judge and the witnesses will be subpoenaed, and only the judge would decide whether the witnesses are credible or not. The problem with that is the judge would be in Savannah, and it's one judge who's been on the bench for more than 40 years. You know, Savannah has a climate of racism and biasness. So, you know, this judge has been on the bench for almost 40 years. So he would decide. If it's a actual trial, then you would come back and you would have the jury that would be the ones that decide, because everything would be able to be just like a open trial. Now, if the judge decided at the hearing that, okay, the witnesses are credible, then you would go to a trial. So my thing is, you can either do two things. You can either deny him, demand that they give him a hearing, which goes before the judge, or demand that they give a full trial, which goes before the judge and a jury. The judge and the jury would be the best thing. It would be better if they got change of venue, because it's a lot of politics here, and you need to move this case out of the city, and it needs to be somewhere else. But
is there a move to do that?
Yes, you are able to do that. You would apply for a change of venue. But, you know, it's up to the local judge to deny it. But this case has national and international attention. They cannot say that this case does not have enough media to justify moving this case out of the city where it's so biased.
And so we're still looking at Troy remaining in prison for the foreseeable future, it sounds like.
Well, if there is a hearing or there's relief given, it will be 6 months to a year before they would even take this back, because they have to get preparation. You have to get trial lawyers to prepare themselves and do what they need to do. So that's what you would need to do. If they deny us, one thing is that our prayer is that they don't do anything before January 1, because the prosecutor that we have now will be out of office. And we'll have a new prosecutor. You know, we could always appeal to the new prosecutor that you should reopen this case. And they have that option. They can do that. This prosecutor that we have here could do it. But see, the prosecutor that we have here, we've had 5 death row exonerations in the state of Georgia. And out of the 5 death row exonerations in the state of Georgia, 2 were from the same prosecutor that prosecuted Troy. They've also been 7 or 8 DNA exonerations in the state of Georgia. And out of those 7, 2 are from here. So this prosecutor's had 4 or 5 men and maybe another 2 or 3 pending that have been exonerated because of misconduct by the prosecutors, withholding evidence, and police coercion. So this prosecutor has done this all throughout his tenure and has been cited several times for prosecutorial misconduct, but he always cites prosecutorial immunity, and nobody has ever punished him.
And is he going to be retiring, or is he out of the system, or is he just moving?
The prosecutor is going to be retiring. Chief assistant prosecutor that has was really entrenched in Troy's case as well, he was running for the DA, and we were praying that he would not get that seat. And he lost. And, you know, these people are so vile that he actually said, I would never lose to a black man. And he said that openly in the public, and he lost. So he's not only burned bridges in our community, but he's burned bridges in a lot of people that are moving in town from, you know, not from Savannah. They're saying, you know, we cannot believe the arrogance of this man. he lost, and so both of them will be leaving. But, you know, the thing about it is, in Savannah, we have judges that nobody ever runs against them. And, you know, even during this election process, I would ask judges, why don't you run against this judge and that judge and this judge? And we would have lawyers that would say, Martina, we can't run against them because it's a good old boy system and we would never win. And if we ran against those judges, we'd be blackballed. So that's the type of city that I live in.
You mentioned this election. Do you think that there's been a change in the way people view things in Georgia itself, or is this business as usual?
It's business as usual. Let me tell you something. Obama only won 4 counties out of 159 in Georgia. Georgia is one of the most racist states. It has been entrenched in the death penalty system since its inception. When they got rid of the death penalty because it was unconstitutional, it was because of a Georgia case. When they brought the death penalty back in the United States, it was because of a Georgia case. You got the Gregg case and the Furman case. Georgia has been entrenched in the death penalty since its inception. Choice case, they've never had a case in the history of 100 years of the death penalty on the books in Georgia where you have 7 out of 9 witnesses recant. You've never had that. You've never had a case where you're trying to kill somebody with no murder weapon, no cause, and then you trump up charges and add things to someone just based on, you know, not even real physical evidence, but just association, because you're really trying to convict and kill somebody. This has been an outrageous case. And the prosecutors come out in the news and say that people that are human rights defenders and people who stand up for Troy, that they're disgusting, they're a curbside circus. So they're attacking. And, you know, came out with this manifesto about why, you know, Troy was convicted. And now that Troy has an oral argument, they ask him questions and he has no comment. And it's really, really amazing. The election here, you know, after every presidential election and things, children in schools, they're usually writing reports and doing things. You got children, black children are told they can't wear Obama shirts. White children are told they can't wear Obama shirts. They can't write reports about it. They can't celebrate in school about Obama. Why is that? We got parents right now that are fucking on the Board of Education is because people will be upset. Well, they'll be upset regardless. So that's where I live.
There's been a lot of information recently that racist incidents, let's call them, have escalated since this election. Are you seeing any of that down there?
Yes, we are. What's really, really sad is that, you know, we have people on the news. We have a lot of Caucasian people on the news that are saying, and it's not all of them, believe me, because most of my friends are non-black, but we have people on the news that are in gun shops. They're saying they're buying guns because Obama is going to take away their gun rights. And I mean, and I'm not talking about they're buying 38 to 45. I'm talking about people on the news in gun shops buying automatic weapons and weapons that you use in wartime. I mean, AK-47s, Uzis. And I'm thinking to myself, well, who are you going to shoot with that? Somebody breaking into your house or, you know, you're going hunting with that? I mean, you're talking about assault rifles, military assault rifles. And these gun shop owners are saying they used to sell 2 or 3 a week. They're selling 10 and 12 a day. And I was like, if you had a bunch of Hispanic or black men up in a gun shop saying that they were buying automatic weapons, they'd be arrested walking out the door.
You'd be right. Well, we're going to stay in touch with you, Martina, and as I say, continue to follow this case. And we're looking with great interest and curiosity about how it all pans out, because on the one side, here in California, we have a sense that things are really moving in a different direction since the Bush administration. But I think what you're seeing down there is
I'm on a whole different planet. I call it the planet of Georgia. I live in the city of Slovanna, because Savannah is so slow and behind human rights. People don't even know the difference between a human right and a civil right. But we have to keep fighting. People ask me all the time, why don't I move? I said, because if every time we move when there's something not right, we'll never have change.
Well, not only that, this is your home.
Yes.
Why should you leave your home?
And I tell everybody, go to Troy's site, TroyAnthonyDavis.org. That's TroyAnthonyDavis.org. And they can find out a lot of information that's going on. We're actually fighting this Dr. Musso that gets paid $18,000 per execution in the state of Georgia. And they can't do an execution without a doctor. They can go on Georgians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty's website and find out some of the actions that we're doing against the doctor.
What is that now, the Georgians?
Georgians for Alternatives Against the Death Penalty is G, F as in Frank, A as in Apple, D as in Dog, P as in Papa. So Georgians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.org. and they can see everything that we're doing, because Dr. Musso gets paid $18,000 per execution. So it's shameful. Well, you know, I have to try to keep fighting. My brother fusses at me all the time because I've been battling cancer for 8 years. He fusses and fusses, but I told him, I said, you know what? Cancer does one of two things. It makes you bitter or it makes you better. And I've always been a person that I never will back down when I see something is wrong. And so if my brother can be where he is and have hope and strength and still pray for the victim's family and all the people who have animosity towards him, then I can be out here doing what I need to do to bring light to this case.
And how is your cancer? Is it in remission at this point?
No, I was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, and I'll always be in treatment. I take chemotherapy every week, and I have to deal with side effects. Right now, I'm on a new medicine that's supposed to be less toxic, but it's actually stripped all of my nails. I had to have 4 of my fingernails surgically removed. So right now, when it's cold outside, my hands feel like I have frostbite. When it's hot, I feel like they're on fire, and I can't really do anything. But you know what? I don't complain, because the doctors gave me 6 months from diagnosis, and that was in 2001, and I'm still here.
It's amazing. Well, we will stay in touch with you and keep you in our hearts, both of you.
Thank you.
That was Martina Correa with an update on Troy Davis's case. It goes to an appeals court December 9th, and we'll continue to follow that case. Now we'll turn to Gloria Johnson, the mother of Montel Johnson, who is currently in Sheridan Correctional Center in Illinois, suffering from chronic progressive multiple sclerosis, dementia, and medical neglect. Montel also suffers from stage 4 bed sores, a blood infection, and hepatitis C contracted when he had some teeth extracted, and they're not directly related to the chronic progressive multiple sclerosis. Montel Johnson's sentence was commuted 3 weeks ago by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, and I asked Gloria Johnson how her son is doing.
Well, at this point, Montel lays in a fetal position. He is unable to talk. Most of the time when he tries to say something, it's so slurred you don't understand it. He depends on everybody to do everything for him. The only thing he has any kind of movement is his right hand arm. And right now, that's flipping and flopping in all directions.
How long has he been like this?
Okay, he's been like this, I want to say 2006, because I'm not too sure. The way they did me in Illinois prisons was just ridiculous. And also, I want to clip the case that out in California, Montel is booked under the case of Marcellus Bates.
Uh-huh.
And that number is K-51131. I had to look it up last night.
How does that work? He's under two different cases?
No. In Illinois, he's cleared. This happened in 93 or 94, the case out in California. My understanding of what I can remember is that it was a liquor store. Montel was supposed to have killed a drug dealer. And in the process of it, they claim he committed armed robbery. But during the trial, they suppressed evidence. And someone sent me a copy of a picture, and this guy was actually about 6 foot tall from the camera they had in the liquor store. And Montel's number was about 5'5", 5'6". And this guy had a huge afro. Well, Montel was wearing curls like Prince. It doesn't even fit, but anyway, evidence was suppressed. California went after the death sentence, but they were unable to do it. So they gave him life without parole. He was here in 94. He came to visit my husband, who had had a massive stroke in 93. And Montel came home. And in the process, you know, he got in contact with old friends. And the young lady, Dorian, warned that he was accused of killing. He really didn't do it. Because I answered the phone that Saturday morning, and I wish I had lied. I'm not a liar. But Dorian was crying. They had threatened her life. And from just Montel's conversation, I didn't hear Dorian's end of it. I told Montel he had a good chance to stay out of it. But he wanted to be the great mediator. And he went down because he knew both parties. Montel was on the scene when the guy, you know, killed her. And then he went back to California. The detectives came here from California with a picture of him. And it said Marcellus Bates. So I told him, yes, that is my son. But I didn't know where he was. So they did eventually pick him up with this guy that actually committed the murder here in Chicago. The guy signed, his name was Carlos Stokes. He signed 4 confessions that he had killed Dorian. They charged him with second-degree murder. because they went after Montel in California. There was an agreement between California and Illinois. Illinois knew that they figured they could get the death sentence on Montel. So between the governor, I think his governor there at the time was named Williams.
Oh, it was Pete Wilson?
Yes. Between what we saw, between the agreements that they made, is that Illinois had committed to them that they could get the death sentence on him. So California sent him back here so Illinois could kill him. Well, then he did end up on death row. But because the mother and I, we fought it, because the mother had already seen the four signed confessions, which disappeared.
Mm.
And they were able to railroad Montel. In 2000, she testified at the trial. I did too. What they told her, that what she thought she felt and what she thought she knew had no bearing on the case. And they sentenced him. Well, actually, Montel asked for death row because he said he was tired of living in a racist society.
Mm.
And he was just tired. And he asked them, because I fainted behind, I heard him say that, and he said he wanted, if they were going to kill him, to do it, and according to Illinois state law, which they don't never do, is that you got to do it in 90 days.
Uh-huh.
And the judge naturally accommodated him, you know, and gave him the death sentence, okay?
Wow.
So we fought it. You know, Terry and I have been fighting this since 2000 together. When Governor Ryan decided to commute those sentences, he said he was taking a special interest in Montel's case. Now, I was told on January the 3rd of 2003 that Montel was going to be exonerated. I don't know what happened in 8 days. But on his birthday, I was sitting next to a news reporter, and by me being in corporate communications at telephone company, I knew that they had press release. So I wanted to see it in writing before they announced it. Well, he didn't let me have the press release, but he read it, and then Montel had 40 years. I don't know what happened in 8 days. But we have been fighting this case. And it's just the point that he was in the Illinois Department of Correction. He was turned back over to the state of Illinois in 98. Now, my first recollection of anything happening to Montel, difficult, was on October the 9th, 1999. Montel was in Macon County Jail down in Decatur. I understand that he slipped up and fell and knocked himself unconscious. The guys, and they tried to call me, they couldn't get me, so they saw my mother's number. And they called her. My mother said she could hear them screaming in the background, getting some help. My mother told me that Montel had been injured. So I called the jailhouse to see could I come. And I was told no, I had to come on my visiting day. So my visiting day was that Tuesday. So I went. And I asked Montel, what did they do for him? And he told me that they gave him Tylenol when he came back around. They never took him to the hospital. They never examined, never did anything. Decatur's it's pretty close to 200 miles from me. So I couldn't go down there a lot because I didn't have anybody to watch my husband, and he was unable to go with me, and I really didn't want him to know what was going on. I was there when they sentenced him up on Montel, but Terry had been there all the time, the mm-hmm. mother. And that Terry visited Montel within the jailhouse. She told me that Montel was stumbling across the room he would come in. The prosecuting attorney said that he was just acting a fool. Nobody bothered to check him in January, because in the prison, when they put him down in the prison, he was doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they checked him then, but they didn't do anything for him. When they told me that he had MS, we did a lot of studying. We knew that he needed physical and occupational therapy as well as the medicine. The prison system refused to give him the physical and occupational therapy. And we had a nurse we found out that was putting, it was Copaxone. They were giving him one of the better medicines. I have to accommodate them for that. But the nurse, for some reason, she was putting it in a muscle. And it wasn't until I called the manufacturer and wanted to know, where's this medicine supposed to go? And he said, it's supposed to go into your body tissue, never a muscle. Montel was complaining about drawing up in a fetal position and excruciating pain. So when I told the warden, he told me that Montel couldn't have a private duty nurse. And so I told him, I said, you know, I didn't call the manufacturer, and I know where that medicine's supposed to go. But now I see all the documentation shows that they put it in his tissue, not in his muscle. So by 2003, Montel was totally paralyzed from the waist down. And then it got worse, because when he got where he couldn't, you know, he couldn't control his hands and stuff, and he couldn't feed himself. He ended up in April with dehydration and severe malnutrition.
And his state of mind at this point, he was still able to talk with you, and he was clear and coherent?
Well, he was clear. Well, he did stutter a lot, you know, slur, but I could understand him. But then by 2005, I mean, it was just you know, downhill. So then we devised a way for me to talk to him, that I would do the ABC, and he would shut his eyes. And when I got to a letter, he would open his eyes, mm-hmm. which is what he's doing now.
So he can only communicate with you with this blinking that he does?
Yes, because when he tries to talk to me and I don't understand him, he'll start crying. It's impossible to understand. So I was trying to figure out a way that we could communicate without him crying.
Yeah.
'Cause I see the tears coming out his eyes. And he'll start groaning, and then he'll get disgusted with himself because he can't talk. And so we devised this method that so I could, I could communicate with him in some form. It took me 5.5 years to get him out of this prison. Because actually, it was 2 state reps I was in touch with, which wasn't my own state rep. And she took compassion, and she went down there over the weekend. They told her that they were short of staff, and she couldn't visit him because they had nobody to escort him from the infirmary to the condemned unit. And she wanted somebody to take her in. But what I lost, when you got a state rep or a senator, they can't refuse them. So she went there to Montel's room. That Montel was filthy. The room smelled of stench for him. So his hair was long down his back. He had facial hairs all down. He had a long beard. Because they weren't taking care of him. He was unable to shave because he was nicking his face. But they did absolutely nothing. They actually let him lay up in that bed, would not feed him, knowing he couldn't hold utensils. I asked him to cut his food up like he would a one-year-old. They wouldn't do it. So this is why he went into severe malnutrition and dehydration, because he couldn't drink, he couldn't eat, he couldn't do anything. She was able to pull some strings in Springfield and get him moved. We were trying to get him in Dixon Correctional Center, which is a medical facility, which is, to my version, it's a total death house. They need to close the place down. But en route from there in November of 2005, they took him to Pontiac. And when I walked in there that day, the warden told me he didn't know why he was there. They could not take care of him. And I told him, well, he was supposed to have been en route to Dixon. But every time I think about the years I tried to get him in Dixon, I could just kick myself, because Dixon was worse than them all. Dixon let him get bed sores. He almost died there. And that place needs to be closed down. The inmates are medically neglected. I'm in federal court now with this case to make a difference inside this city, this state. I know that I'm going to lose my son. Right now, he's in the end stages of MS.
And what you're trying to do is to get him released so he can come home.
Come home and die. Well, Illinois has released him because they don't want to pay the hospital bill. But they went into court right after they released him. But I don't even think they contacted California to start the expedition to take him back to California. This man cannot make it.
They want to still put him to death at this point?
Put him to death at this point. I will give you his website, and you see some stuff that they did to me when I went to federal court against him.
Okay, your website is?
www.monteljohnsonblogspot.com.
Okay, monteljohnson.blogspot.com.
I'm trying to make a difference. If I got to lose my child, I don't want another mother to go through what I've been through.
And you are a member of the campaign to end the death penalty at this
Very
point?
Very active. I'm on the steering committee. I have a subcommittee. It's called Family Members and Friends Network. And what we do is try to get the families to get more involved in it. We have a Christmas party and we sign cards. And last year I was able to raise enough to send 52 inmates, $25 each. And I do this every year. But I'm trying to get the parents, and what it is, I mean, I'm 65 myself. So a lot of them are older than me. It's just trying to keep them involved. But I know this age and different elements too. They don't come out like they used to. I'm with the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. That organization was formed around Andrew Davis years ago. That's where the medical is coming in.
We'll talk about that.
He's on hold for California. They tried to take him in an ambulance 25 miles. Some of the guards are human. They mentioned it to me. I was out there. They see me come out there 5 days a week.
You drive up there.
174 miles, 5 days a week. Montel, he's in limbo. Illinois has released him. They're waiting for California to come get him. I don't know how long Illinois can hold him if California don't come get him. He filed an executive clemency with Governor Swergenegger last.
Oh, he did. He got that.
Yeah, we got that. We filed that. We're trying to get either a compassionate release or get a sentence commuted.
Yeah, and then he can come home to your place.
Didn't come home to my house. I'm willing to take care of him. I'd rather fun to be here. I'm trying to get my place fixed up, and I'm running through the bureaucracy because he's over 21. Social Security won't tell me about his SS disability insurance.
I know that all inmates here have Medicaid cards. Our problem is that we have a medical facility company outsource the services. And this company's making mega bucks letting inmates die. We're trying to get the ACLU to go after him. Like I said, the Illinois Department of Corrections basically wants to kill him. And at this point, because they're mad at me, they will do anything rather than let me have him.
And Gloria, how are you actually doing? I mean, you're driving up there every day. You're fighting these battles, struggling.
Because I'm not paying bills, and I just got into a dilemma, so I'm not going to worry about it. Because you know, I pay my house note, I pay my gas, my light, well, some parts of it. But I was looking, and I just realized that I had missed some bills. You know, these companies, they got more money than I got. I'm on Social Security. I'm not going to forego seeing my child a bill. That ain't going to happen. I am not going to worry about it. If they cut everything else off, I'll go stay with my mother and try and get it back on. I'm not going to worry about it. Energy right now is, I know that I'm losing my son. Actually, he has lived longer than the doctor said that he was going to make it. And I knew when the doctor told me that God has the final say. But I see him getting weaker every day, so I know it's a matter of time. At this point now, I saw him as low as 55 pounds. He's nothing but skin and bone. He doesn't have any muscle or tissue. In 2006, I found the first bed sore. But me being ignorant, because he was complaining about his back around the sacral area, I thought bed sores start from the top and go down, or they start from the bone and come up. And so behind that, they quit me from going into his room, and they would bring him out. Because they put in this chair where I couldn't move him around to see what was going on. And then when they did let me back into his room last year, every time they got ready, if he had a bowel movement or something, they had to change him. They made me go out of his room, down the corridor, through some double doors locked, because they didn't want me to see his body. I didn't see his body until October the 20th last year. He had the one on his back. You could look and see his bone. And then he had the one on his left hip. The one on his right, the one on the left hip has healed. The one on the right, the doctor told me that it wasn't going to heal. And so we did surgery. And that's not really working right now. And I saw pus coming out of it. The nurse called the doctor, who told her that he would look at him when he came in. He didn't come in till Monday. And when he came in, guess what? There was blood coming out. You know, he was aware of this Friday afternoon when I discovered it, because I went to try to pull my leg down, and I saw the pus. I called her on for the nurse and showed it to her, and she immediately called the doctor. I can't take a camera in. I can't take anything in but my car keys and my ID. But I need, because I reported to the attorney that the sacred room in the back had opened up. I see where they wrote him and said it hasn't, and it has. I know what I saw. I know that when he went into the hospital, they took pictures of these wounds and things. You know, they have denied they took pictures, but I know every hospital takes pictures. So the attorney told me not to worry about it, that he can subpoena those hospital records.
Okay.
And I want to get those pictures, and I want to expose them and let people see what they did to him. My mother asked me in 2005, which is why I'm doing this. He told me that he didn't want another inmate to go through what he's going through with. But he did tell me, and I didn't know how hard it was going to be. He said, Mama, I'm going to tell you like this. You may lose me in the fight, but I want you to go to the end. And I promised my child that. And I'll tell you, you know, it's hard. But I will do, because I've never promised him anything and didn't do it. So I made my commitment to him in 2005, and I intend to make a difference in this state and hope somebody will make it across the country.
That was Gloria Johnson, Illinois mother of Montel Johnson, a tireless fighter for abolition of the death penalty and a member of the campaign to end the death penalty. She is currently working for Montel to be released so he can die at home with dignity. You can call California Governor Schwarzenegger's office at 916-445-2841 or fax at 916-558-3160 and ask that Montel be processed out and sent home. Again, those numbers, office 916-445-2841 or fax 916-558-3160. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. As usual, all views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. You're invited to email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org and suggest shows you'd like to hear in the future or to comment on any shows that you do hear. Or you can listen to our archive shows at www.raisingsandradio.org. Join us next week when we'll remember Peter Cameo, activist, Green Party co-founder and founder of Progressive Asset Management, a brokerage firm whose vision looks towards the day when environmental and economic justice takes precedence over corporate greed.